Chapter 12. Maynard hadn't moved to Arizona to start a vineyard. A decade into his music career, there was no logical reason to change course now.
Tool and A Perfect Circle were creative outlets, and I wasn't about to abandon them, but I felt unbalanced. No, I didn't move to Arizona to start a vineyard, but when I got there, I wanted to express my ideas in a three-dimensional form, which becomes a fourth-dimensional form if you do it right.
Rehearsals and recording kept him in L.A. much of the time, and to maintain his center as best he could, he installed mats in the Tool loft and scheduled private jiu-jitsu lessons with Gracie studio instructor Henry Akins. Akins arrived one afternoon with his friend and fellow martial arts enthusiast Todd Fox. Tool had just wrapped a rehearsal, and Henry was going to give Maynard a lesson, Todd explained in a 2014 interview. He asked if I'd mind helping him do a little training. In his years working security for celebrities from Janet Jackson to Madonna to Motley Crue, Todd had crossed paths with plenty of entertainers, and after an afternoon of wrestling and leverage training, he knew that Maynard was unique to the industry. He was quiet and down to earth, and there was no pretentious vibe, Todd would recall. Maynard can get work done, and he can joke around, too. He can transition between worlds, which not a lot of people can do. It wasn't long before the two had found a comfortable camaraderie. They met often to discuss their shared military backgrounds and their careers, their common interests in travel and music and fine wine. And just before the Lateralis tour began, Maynard suggested Todd come on board to not only provide security, but to serve as Maynard's on-the-road jiu-jitsu instructor. From the days of Tool's first European tour, Maynard had seen from the bus windows the terraced hillsides of Tuscany, vines trained up over trellises, and plump clusters of grapes among the leaves. His cellar and his palate had expanded since Tory's gift of the silver oak, and he'd grown more and more curious about the process that could transform fruit and rain and sunshine to Barolo and Shiraz and bold California Cabernet. A free afternoon in Italy during the 2000 Mer de Nome tour had left time for a stopover at Ken Berry's vineyard just outside Siena. The head of Virgin Entertainment managed every facet of his small winery on site, and the visit would be Maynard's chance to conduct a bit of first-hand research. He wanted to know everything, Nancy Berry would recall. Ken pointed out his vats and barrels, explained the quality control lab and the bottling area and the corking apparatus. Maynard looked out over the lush rows of vines as Ken described the soil composition and climate that made Siena an ideal spot for a vineyard. "I had no frame of reference to understand what he was talking about," Maynard would recall. "I just knew this is what it felt like when I stood outside my house. It didn't look much different from where I lived." And not long after, a break in the Lateralis tour allowed him to accept an invitation from concert merchandising exec and enophile Bruce Fingerette. The dinner would include a double-blind wine tasting, and Maynard thought it might be his next step in understanding. Never one to blindly follow standard operating procedure, Maynard insisted Todd join him at the table. Bodyguard protocol required that security station themselves apart from the main event and keep the curious and the questionable at a safe distance from their charge. But, Maynard reasoned, Todd was a part of the team, and he would share in the experience. And Todd was no stranger to fine wines. "I'd sometimes run errands for the artist I'd worked for," he would explain. "I'd bring back Gaia or Lafitte or Latour to them and attended samplings on my nights off." He'd surely enjoy the evening as much as Maynard. Appetizers and entrees and desserts appeared in their turn, dishes chosen to complement and contrast with the wines and create pairings that enhanced the subtle characteristics of both. Sommelier circled the table with Burgundies and Bordeaux, their labels disguised in brown paper wrappers, and the guests accepted the task of identifying just what they were drinking. Maynard and Todd, spittoon at his side, sipped Lafitte Rothschild and Ponceau Griot, and Montiano, and tried their best to appreciate balance and texture, hints of fruits and flowers and spice. They left it to the others to discern varietals and vintages, and even, based on subtle terroir, particular vineyards, to peg the 1997 Flacianello, the 1998 Cheval Blanc, the 1982 Trottinois. I'd never seen anything like it, Todd would remember. If you'd told me somebody could do that, I would have called bullshit immediately. But several of them were around 80% accurate, which is pretty phenomenal. Maynard and Todd didn't have quite the refined palates of their companions, but they'd uncorked their share of Merlots and Rieslings and were experienced enough to realize that the 1990 Gianfranco Soldera Reserva far outranked the other wines in the flight. It was just off the charts, Todd would recall. It was as velvety as you can get and really round with a long finish. No bitterness or bite whatsoever. It was like experiencing 4 or 5 or 6 different things off one sip. It was like cherries on steroids.
Everybody has that moment when they suddenly see the light about wines. I had that moment with a Silver Oak from Torrey. Then this dinner flipped the other switch. Not only was I into wine, I now wanted to plant vines and see where I could take this.
Maynard realized he wasn't far from the makings of fine wines. The hills surrounding the Jerome house were the same southeast-facing slopes he'd seen in Spain and Piemonte, the Arizona soil similar to that in Bordeaux and Champagne. But constructing a vineyard would take work, more work certainly than pulling together a band. It would mean dirt under his fingernails, and learning about zoning regulations and water rights and root systems and powdery mildew. But he approached his mission with the same methodical passion he'd brought to Tool's formation. Maynard's projects are not just business to him, Nancy Berry would explain. He has a very deep personal commitment to everything he does, and he's very hands-on. One step at a time, he would put the pieces in place. He drew sketches of vineyard design and read about pH levels and soil preparation. He bought up suitable properties and hired contractors to grade the earth. And by 2003, the garden near his house had been planted with Cabernet Sauvignon and named the Judith Block. By necessity, much of the initial development was done remotely, with help from Mike, who'd stayed in Jerome when Maynard set off on a 19-city Lollapalooza tour to promote APC's second album. Recorded in Billy's basement studio with assistance from guitar tech Matt Mitchell, 13th Step was a 12-song collection that moved from hard-driving rock to symphonic instrumentals to Joni Mitchell-inspired guitar, reflecting its theme of multiple paths to self-discovery. The album's release on September 16, 2003, kicked off the tour in earnest, a tour that would keep APC on the road for nearly a year. When Maynard at last unpacked his suitcase the next summer, it was time to begin work on the next Tool album. If the vineyard was ever to be a reality, he'd need help keeping his plate spinning and the pieces of his life in order. Lei Lee had never intended to work for a rock musician, particularly one she'd read could be difficult and distant. When a mutual friend introduced her to Maynard, she was far from starstruck. "I knew of Tool, but I didn't listen to their music," she recalled in a 2015 interview. "I heard that they weren't nice to people, so I didn't really want to meet him because I was afraid. What do you say to somebody like that?" To her surprise, she found Maynard soft-spoken and approachable, and not a little attractive. They eased effortlessly into a comfortable friendship, and when he asked her if she'd become his personal assistant, she realized it might be her ticket out of her small Midwestern town and a step closer to applying her art degree. For the next 2 years, she maintained Maynard's schedule and ran his errands and kept the L.A. house functioning smoothly. A plum assignment while she searched for the perfect job with one of the city's galleries or museums. And when plans for the vineyard were well underway, he suggested she come to Jerome and oversee operations there. "I was like, yeah, right," she would recall. "I'd always wanted to move to the city, and now he was asking me to come to this town that's smaller than my high school class." But the two worked well together, laughed and conversed, and enjoyed each other's company. And joining him in Arizona wouldn't be the worst move she could make, so long as she kept an eye out for other opportunities and maintained her professional distance. Over the years, she'd had a front-row view of his romantic indiscretions, the dramas and deceptions, and she knew he wasn't exactly prime relationship material. She'd seen, too, All We Are Saying, Rosanna Arquette's 2005 documentary of entertainers from Burt Bacharach to Yoko Ono to Steven Tyler, who spoke of their inspirations, their struggles to balance family and fame, and their takes on the changing music industry. She'd listened to her boss explain in his 2-minute monologue that, at 40, he was too old to change, that his destiny would never include monogamy. "I thought I was doomed to a series of failed relationships and sexual recklessness," Maynard would explain. "Ending that took getting a dog." The family dog, a white picket fence, Saturdays spent planting peas and lettuce with his children. Despite his doubt, the dream was still attractive. Just maybe his girlfriend of the moment was the one he'd been waiting for. He'd moved her sometime before into the L.A. house. But one afternoon, Maynard and his little Yorkie, Miho, discovered she hadn't taken her vow of fidelity quite as seriously as he.
"I came home and found that my home and my trust had been violated. I was enraged. Then my dog looked up at me. She looked down at the truck keys I'd thrown down and then up at me. Here was the physical manifestation of my inner voice, in the form of Miho. It was like she's saying, 'Just pick up the keys and drive to the vineyard and walk away from this chaos.' Things had to change. I picked up the keys, I picked up the dog, I got in the truck, and I headed to Jerome. The dog saved my life."
Maynard's friends had for years cleared their social calendars when Tool or APC came through town. When he'd begun to cut breakfasts short and bring glamorous strangers to dinner, when his phone calls stopped altogether, they joked among themselves that he'd gone hopelessly rock star. But they'd been patient. They knew that no matter how circuitous his detour, the Maynard they remembered would be back. "Maynard always opts to reconnect," Todd would explain. "Comfort and familiarity are fuel for him. He needs that foundation to continue moving forward, and once he establishes a sense of connection, he rarely lets it go." It remained in city after impersonal city, that connection forged over seafood omelets and turkey dinners, the family created from strangers on sunny roof decks and fifth-floor walk-ups where candles burned and where, regardless of miles and time, no one needed be alone. "There were a couple patches of years when I didn't even talk to him," Laura Milligan would recall. "But Maynard is loyal. When he's your friend forever." When he returned to Tantrum, she'd be in the wings, ready to pull on her cowgirl boots. Sheila would welcome him at the neighborhood and refill his coffee cup before he asked. Steele would retell stories of fish food hors d'oeuvres, and Ramiro would be waiting to puzzle out with him synchronicity and convergence. Kurt would turn, catch his glance, and understand the unspoken joke. "I didn't have a trail of breadcrumbs to get me back," Maynard would explain. "I had 30-pound test fishing line. The tether was strong. These weren't breadcrumbs. They were shining rubies." He turned from the dusty road and parked the truck in the driveway. In the backyard, Laylee was hard at work, surrounded by hammers and drills, repairing the doghouse. She'd filled the irrigation pool, coiled the garden hose neatly around the hook at the side of the house, and shut off the sprinklers in the vineyard. Plenty of naysayers had told Maynard his venture was a fool's errand, that grapes could never grow in the Arizona desert. But Maynard had done his research and accepted the job not as a chore, but a perfectly doable challenge. Miho bounded across the yard to greet Laylee, and Maynard stood for a moment and looked out over the Judith block, where green shoots trembled in the evening breeze.
"At the end of the movie Bliss, when the father plants trees, it's really a love letter that took 7 years to deliver. I understood that planting those vines on some level was my love letter to my family, to my community, to my younger self, to my future self. I'd already started writing that love letter, but I'd been sending it in the wrong direction. If you're going to do something, you do it. You don't worry about who your audience is. You do it for you. You do it for the music. You do it for the art. You do it for the vineyard.
The vineyard was an oasis of greening vines, of hummingbirds and hawks overhead, and praying mantises in the grass, and the resident roadrunner just down the hill. Maynard rose with the sun and knelt in his gardens, his senses tuned to breezes and honeybees, to rain clouds that gathered each afternoon in the east. He helped his crew remove weeds and clear debris from the paths between Sangiovese and Cabernet, and lined the steep terraces with white limestone boulders the way he'd seen done in Tuscany and Siena. Creating a vineyard was a test of himself as much as of the land, a chance to allow the synchronistic accidents of weather and will that might alter his story. And in a few years, he imagined, his harvest might produce a palatable bottle or two. His dream wasn't so far-fetched. Grapes actually started in the desert, he would explain. They were originally drought-tolerant plants, bred for exactly this kind of environment. Read your Bible. The Arizona soil was ideal for grape growing. The layers of volcanic ash deposited long ago, and the rich caliche, the remnant of the vast inland sea that had once covered the state. Spanish missionaries had arrived there in the 16th century and found the valley purple with wild grapes, and they'd made of them their sacramental wine. Later, Prescott hotelier Henry Schurman had established the area's first winery and provided libations for loggers and cattle drivers and miners, until the vines were destroyed with the advent of Prohibition in 1915. By the late 1980s, a hopeful few had begun to resurrect the state's vineyards and try their hand at winemaking, and Maynard saw no reason he shouldn't join them. Stepping from the spotlight never crossed his mind, not while his career continued its upswing. Just before his first vines went in the ground, Anima was certified triple platinum, and Lateralis reached double platinum by that August. The next November, just in time for Election Day 2004, when foreign relations and the war on terrorism were top of mind, A Perfect Circle released its third album. Certified gold only a month after its release, Emotive included originals and covers of anti-war anthems, from Joni Mitchell's Fiddle and the Drum to John Lennon's Imagine, the fresh interpretations a portal to hearing the familiar lyrics as if for the first time. And the next year, Maynard's acting chops were at last showcased. He'd appeared a few years before in the low-budget Bikini Bandits action film parodies, but it took his role opposite Ed Asner and Rage Against the Machine's Brad Wilk in the indie murder mystery Sleeping Dogs Lie to bring accolades from reviewers and recognition of his comic skill from fans. Maynard brought such a depth to the character, co-producer Ford Englerth said of his deadpan portrayal of bumbling Deputy Sheriff Lance. He took a character that was very kind of quirky, not-so-bright kind of deputy, and he spent a lot of time developing particular nuances about how the character thinks and his motivation. Limelight aside, what mattered now was determining which vines might be best suited to conditions on the mountain. Keenan family lore included the tale of great-grandfather Marzo, who, in some time out of mind, had lived on the Italian-French border and made wines from grapes that grew in his arbor. Maynard knew little more of his paternal heritage, and in a nod to this Marzo, whatever his full name, whatever his story, he planted on the Judith block, alongside Aglianico and Tempranillo, a Nebbiolo clone of a grape native to his ancestors' homeland. He planted two descendants of the Lulienga, the strain that had been all but lost in 1915. A neighbor found a vine nearby that had been kept alive by two sisters we call the Tamale Ladies, he would explain. One of them was Aurelia, and her husband was a Spanish gentleman the miners had brought over to make their wine. When Prohibition hit, they had to pull out their vineyard. but the sisters had rooted cuttings in glass jars on their windowsill and transplanted them in their gardens, and Lulienga had survived to begin its new history in Merkin Vineyards. Maynard's travels had prepared him well for the challenges ahead. During APC's 2000 Adelaide stop, he'd walked the Penfolds acreage, toured its cellars, and listened to master winemakers John Duval and Peter Gayo. "He wanted to know about anything and everything," Gayo recalled in a 2016 interview. He was interested in canopy management, the winemaking process, barrel maturation, and tasting.
Peter told me how back in the 50s, a young Penfolds winemaker, Max Schubert, coming from a background of sweet fortified wines, was sent to France to study sherry making. He discovered over there the dry, intense, delicate reds. He came back with a glow in his eye and tried to explain to his bosses that this was something they should embark on. They reluctantly gave him a small budget, and he figured out through trial and error that the best fruit they had in the area was the Shiraz grape. When they finally released the wine, people were used to sweet sherries, ports, and brandies. They didn't understand this dry red with aging potential, so they laughed in his face and shut him down. But he knew the truth. He knew that he has to continue for their sake, so he continued in secret. Then in 1962, he entered the Penfolds 1955 Grange Hermitage in wine competitions and blew everybody away. The reason you're even aware of Australian wine is because Schubert and like-minded people made the right choices and pushed through. He was the kind of pioneer who said, "I have a vision, you're wrong now, but you'll be right and you'll all benefit." He stuck to his guns and he didn't give up.
If Schubert had surmounted his obstacles, Maynard would have an even easier time of it, with Google at his fingertips and reference books delivered overnight to his doorstep. A successful vineyard, he learned, was an exercise in balance. If he pruned too much, the fruit would shrivel in the sunlight and become useless. A light hand on the pruning shears would bring on voracious foliage that trapped rain and dew, and then he'd have to deal with bunch rot. There would be monsoons and winter frosts, pesticides that might do more harm than good, and the red tape nightmares of applications and regulations of a bewildering bureaucracy. "When we started planting, I installed a tank to collect spring water that flowed down the hill to irrigate the vineyard," he would recall. The town couldn't wrap their head around that. The word tank wasn't in their ordinance code. It would take time to outfit a winery of his own, and years before his fruit would be ready for harvest. But if he had to put one goal on the back burner, he'd take advantage of the delay and reach another. Working as a custom crush client at a brand new winery in nearby Cornville would give him access to its facility, and sourcing fruit from California growers and turning their grapes to wine would be a hands-on PhD program in fermentation and filtration and temperature control. He might not know from 1 year to the next which grape he'd receive, but the annual surprise would force him to learn the qualities and potential of Malvasia and Syrah. Smoky and citrusy, with a curious black tea finish, his debut, the Caduceus 2004 Primer Paso, literally his first step, caught the attention of music fans and enophiles curious to sample the latest celebrity release. The limited edition Syrah and Malvasia blend sold out in no time and paved the way for the earthy Nahual de la Naga, the oaky, plummy Nahual del Sensei, and the Merkin Vineyards smoky smooth Chupacabra. Encouraged by the success of his custom crush creations, Maynard began to imagine what might come of his vines growing now on just under 7 acres, Sangiovese and Tempranillo thriving in the Arizona sunshine, the Cabernet in the Judith block, the most vigorous and hardy of all. Nearly a year and a half on the road would take him from pruning and pressing and blending. But Tool's 10,000 Days tour that began in 2007 wouldn't interrupt his studies. Stops across Europe were scheduled to coincide with the release of Italian and Bordeaux vintages, and wine aficionados were introduced to a new side of Maynard via his Wine Spectator blog, On Tour with Maynard James Keenan, his chronicle not of performances, but of vineyard visits and the wines he sampled in fine restaurants across the continent, a 40-year tawny port in Lisbon, a Vieux Telegraph Châteauneuf du Pape in Paris. By 2009, Caduceus Cellars was licensed and outfitted and operational. The compact bunker attached to the Jerome House was an assembly line of destemmers and vats and testing lab and oak barrels modeled after the wineries he'd explored. "I'd watched the basic process," he said. "The fruit comes in, you either destem it or you don't. You either press it or you don't. It ends up in a bin or a tank. Then you ferment it. Every facility is going to be a version of that." The setup was simple, yes. But mastering the more esoteric tricks of this new trade, the tricks that would transform grape juice to tannic reds and dry whites and oaky blends, would take more than observation. He must incessantly taste and test and tweak, make on-the-fly decisions about too high sugar levels or too unripe grapes. Most important, he must keep always in mind Peter Gago's advice and step out of his own way and let the grapes guide the process.
"People come in and taste wine that's fermenting. They make an ugly face and they say it's awful. Of course it is. It's not done. Same as if I play a rough track. You can tell that they want to say it's terrible. Then I play the song when it's completed or pour the finished wine, and then they think it's great. It's the same with anything you do. Getting to the finished product is about patience, understanding, and a faith in the process."
It wasn't a process he would tackle solo. The vineyard would require a harvest crew and a vineyard crew, drivers and accountants and sales reps, and to oversee them all, a manager in Chris Turner, trained in his family's California vineyards, and who now made it his mission to understand the challenges and advantages of growing grapes in Arizona. It would take, too, someone to test pH and sulfur dioxide levels and conduct assessments to gauge the fermentation process. "I had avoided chemistry when I was in college," Leili would admit, but she'd worked side by side with the pros at the custom crush facility and had studied winemaking nearly as diligently as Maynard had, and her respect and admiration for him had risen over the years until she believed as strongly in his dream as he. "We worked really well together," she explained. "I knew even then that I always wanted to be a part of whatever he did." And despite her early reservations about such things, she found herself promoted from personal assistant to lab manager, a part of the team that would hold one another accountable and recognize the importance of their individual excellence to the success of Caduceus Cellars. In the beginning, anyone would think, "You're going to start a vineyard in Arizona?" Nancy Berry would reflect. But Maynard did it. And not only did he do it, he takes so much pleasure in it and he puts so much physical hard work into it. This was no prima donna celebrity cavalierly adding winemaking to his resume. From the beginning, Maynard was the one slipping Led Zeppelin and Joni Mitchell CDs into the player in the bunker and bending over the vat, punching down with his fist the thick stew of grape skins and purple liquid. He was the one who monitored the juice as it aged, sampled the blends at every stage, and moved tons of Sangiovese Grosso and Tempranillo during the long, hot weeks of the harvest season.
"Once the grapes are picked, I'll be at the bunker waiting for the forklift. Chris packs the truck up and I unload the fruit, weigh it, and put it in the destemmer. From there it goes into bins where Leili does all the testing. Then I either inoculate it or allow it to naturally ferment, then press it and put it into bins to settle. Eventually it goes into barrels and I stack them. Or I'm cleaning up. I power wash the press and the destemmer because that's what has to be done. I'm not going to go find some manservant to do any of that for me."
"There have always been surprises," Tom Morello would say of Maynard's new role. "When we lived in L.A., we were driving around and he told me he had a West Point background. He went from whatever he was before that to being a West Point guy to being a pet store guy. Maynard's not afraid of a sharp left turn." But winemaking was not so much a change in direction as a shift in perspective, a seamless opening to another aspect of Maynard's art. Maynard and Chris had nurtured the vineyard through 100-degree August afternoons, hail and monsoons and drought, Pierce's disease and too high potassium levels, and the weedy jungle that overwhelmed the plots with the first drops of rain. they'd placed frost pans and covered with tarps the tender vines against icy winds, and followed the advice of Kurt, who'd experimented with grape growing on his Vermont hilltop and laid a crushed rock ground cover to insulate against the night air that settled over the valley. They learned that the stressors only produced grapes more hardy and resilient, and learned, too, to avoid tarantulas and scorpions hiding among the leaves, and that warding off angry javelinas was a snap. "You scare the boss off with an air rifle, and they don't come back," Maynard would explain. The alchemy of rain and sun and soil, and 6 years of backbreaking work, had transformed the dream to reality. In 2009, Maynard released the first wine made entirely from Caduceus Cellars grapes, the 2007 Nawal del Judith, named in memory of his mother. The tannic Cabernet echoed with cassis and black olive, and Judith's dream was printed on the back of the dark bottle. "As a child, I used to dream that I could fly. I would stand on one leg, look up towards the sky, and with my arms lifted out and up, my fingers stretched towards the sun, the wind would come and swirl all around me, and then gently lift me up into the air." On that mild April day, a soft breeze rustled the Cabernet leaves, and Maynard stood on the eastern slope of the Judith Block. "These vines and wines are her resurrection and her wings," Maynard said. He uncorked the first bottle, tipped it, and returned the wine to the earth, a ritual of new beginnings. With one Caduceus success under his belt, he set his sights on the next challenge. "Maynard always asks, how do we make this more interesting?" Todd would explain. "How do we make it more fun and better than what it is?" The barreled Sangiovese and Cabernets in the bunker were redolent of old-world blends, and given another few months of aging, Maynard imagined them an Arizona interpretation of the Super Tuscans he'd sampled in Italy, a confluence of his heritage and his future.
"Had a free afternoon during the 10,000 Days tour. We had a family reunion of sorts at Burns Steakhouse in Tampa, Florida. My dad had flown down from Michigan to visit my Uncle Herb, whom I hadn't seen in about 30 years, and we toasted each other in vintage Lafitte. I told Uncle Herb about the vineyards, and I told him I was doing a new blend in honor of his grandfather that was going to be called Nigual de Marzo. I explained that I knew next to nothing about this guy. But Herb knew something. His name was John Marzo, he told me. His nickname was Spirit. I looked around the table to see if Todd or my dad were playing some kind of prank. They do that kind of thing. But they weren't messing with me this time. My great-grandfather's nickname really was Spirit. And I'd already named my wine. It would be called Nigual de Marzo, which means the spiritual essence of Marzo."
With an eye for beauty and balance and style, Maynard oversaw the design of all things Caduceus. He'd discovered that marketing was far from a soulless chore. Maynard is very sensitive to the imagery involved in marketing and publicity, Kendall instructor Deb Rockman would explain. He wants art to be a significant part of everything he does. He led the creation of the Caduceus Cellars website, a virtual diary with deckle edge pages rich with photographs and maps and pen and ink illustrations. He imported from Canada sleek, weighty bottles and made of each an objet d'art. Name and vintage and alcohol content were printed in bold inks directly on the glass, and lyrical tales of fantastic beasts and magical guardians and shapeshifters, and the Merkin logo, a swirling interpretation of classical artworks and geometric symbols, their meanings as multi-layered as the wine's finishes. Ramiro's paintings and woodcuts had been adapted for use in Tool promotional materials since 1994, and now his image, touched down, appeared on a Caduceus t-shirt. When space became available in Jerome's historic Connor Hotel, Maynard realized that its footprint matched plans he'd sketched for an offshoot of the vineyard. He supervised the metamorphosis to the Caduceus Cellars tasting room, a welcoming space of wood and brick and sunny window tables. The Flatiron, the Main Street cafe that had won Maynard over to Jerome, was no more, and its managers, Brian and Alan, took charge and created a destination for locals who gathered for their daily espresso and for visitors eager to sample a flight of Arizona wines. Maynard planned rehearsals and recording sessions around the harvest and production schedule, and, ever the businessman, continued promotions along the tour route. At every stop, he dispatched Todd to call on distributors and retailers and restaurant owners and tell the Caduceus story. At first, it was very difficult to get people to listen, Todd would recall. People in the wine community had no time for Maynard. They didn't care about another rock star slapping their name on a label. True wine connoisseurs, like sommeliers and buyers, they were kind of shunning it. But after sipping the tannic reds, the rich rosés, the Caduceus Naga or Sensei or Sancha, the restaurateurs sat up and took notice. These were intriguing wines, they realized, complex and delicate, wines that would step from center stage and allow the flavors of their entrees to expand and transform. They recognized the win-win wisdom in giving their chefs a free hand in creating pairings to enhance both the wines and their cuisine. Fish eyes and fish sperm in Tokyo, pastas and meats and cheeses at Babo on Waverly Place in Manhattan, guinea hen and creamy polenta at Mark's American Cuisine in Houston. The all-Arizona wine list at Scottsdale's F&B restaurant soon included Caduceus Dos Ladrones and Oneste and Malvasia blends. We serve an heirloom tomato salad with golden, crispy, steamy hot polenta croutons, Pavle Milik, F&B co-owner, explained in a 2014 interview. You need a wine that's not going to overpower the sweet tomatoes and the red wine vinegar and onions. Maynard's Marzo Sangiovese Rosé with that dish is out of this world. It didn't take much convincing before Mark Tarbell, Arizona Republic wine columnist and proprietor of Tarbell's in Phoenix, offered Caduceus wines in both his dining room and in the restaurant's wine shop. I am my customer's advocate, Tarbell said. I have to put wine in front of them that has value, and some of Maynard's wines are outstanding. I see honest expression in his bottles and grapes and choice of blendings. And Maynard began to take part in Tarbell's annual dinner gala to benefit the Arizona Wine Growers Association. I'm the chef, and he's the celebrity, Tarbell explained. He'll cook, plate, and serve. He's got some good skills and some good moves around the kitchen. The kitchen in the Jerome house shifted into high gear. Maynard slipped over his head, his white apron, and recreated the gnocchi and roast lamb he remembered from the North End, grilled salmon, a Thanksgiving pizza. I go to Maynard's house, and he'll be waiting on me like I'm in a restaurant, Todd explained. That love comes from a very specific place. Maynard's feasts arose, too, from the need for a bit of bench research.
People usually drink my wines in restaurants, so I experiment by pairing them with restaurant-style food. I make a ravioli from Arizona wheat dough and local eggs and herbs, and serve it with my wine and a top-notch wine as a comparison. If mine doesn't measure up, I've got to go figure out what I did wrong. If it does, I gotta figure out what the heck I did right so I can repeat it. Thanksgiving pizza was Laylee's idea. Derek, who works in our vineyards, is an awesome pizza maker. So he did a dough and we lined the deep dish crust with turkey, gravy, stuffing, and topped it with cranberries. With that, we opened a Tuscan blend and barrel tasted some Oneste, our Caduceus Merlot Barbera blend.
Winemaking was certainly no longer just a hobby. By 2015, annual production had reached 6,000 cases. Caduceus wines were sold in 1,000 retail outlets and shipped to customers in 33 states, and Maynard's vineyards covered 115 acres throughout Arizona. His collection of silver and gold medals only grew. Awards from the Jefferson Cup Invitational, the Texas Sommelier Conference, and the San Francisco International Wine Competition, and the F&B Judgment of Arizona blind tasting that pitted Arizona wines against those of California, Italy, Spain, France, and Australia, and ranked the Caduceus 2008 Nahual del Judith above all other reds. Doubters had set a lofty bar, but there was no denying it now. The rocker in blue body paint and a mohawk was a winemaker. "Things have changed a lot," Todd explained in a 2014 interview. "When Maynard talks about winemaking now, people realize he's not some clown off the street." The job of Merkin Vineyard's frontman would involve more than producing a fine bottle of rosé, and Maynard added to his email signature, "World-class multitasker." The hard-won lessons of the vineyard must be shared. "Maynard really does give a shit about what's happening here," Millick explained. "Let's call him the gateway winemaker." The picture of professionalism in tailored suit and tie, he quietly articulated at Jerome community meetings the needs and triumphs of area winemakers and took part in winemaker panels and seminars on cultivation and pest control and the latest in submerged cap fermentation. And as part of the 2012 Arizona Centennial Celebration, he stressed the importance of sustainable agriculture to the state's future.
"Back in Scottville, I watched my family and neighbors grow much of their own food, so I understood, even then, what it is to be sustainable. We lived within our means, and we were creative with what we had. If you had a farm or a vineyard, no matter what else is happening in the world, you can survive. Throughout history, people got by in spite of the wars, the weather, and whoever was in charge, kings, queens, dictators, fascists. They understood how to maintain a connection with their place and how to feed themselves from that place. The cornerstone of that activity was most often vines."
If the effort were properly managed and regulated, Maynard imagined, winemaking could become the industry to bring economic stability to Arizona. His vineyards did their small part, provided his crew a living wage, and by extension, strengthened the local tax base. And should the winemaking movement go statewide, the effect could be far-reaching. Maynard, one of 10 Arizona thought leaders invited to speak at the 2015 Local First Arizona event, encouraged potential growers to do their part, to commit themselves to possibility, to avoid the easy path and work through the inevitable friction that would yield the greatest rewards. "That's where the art happens," he explained. "The sweetest music from strings stretched to their limit, the most moving poem created in the night's darkest despair, the finest wines from vineyards tested by drought and frost and blight." If new vintners were to succeed, they would need an advocate, and Maynard became a self-appointed spokesperson, appealing to legislators for fair zoning and distribution policies that would move winemaking from a cottage industry to a significant economic force. Arizona wine, he insisted, was a unique commodity, a global export that celebrated the local, each bottle the essence of desert herbs and spice, of chalky earth, and Palo Verde in bloom.
"Wine is a product that can't be outsourced to China or Mexico. It expresses our home, our place, our Arizona. The essence of why a wine is interesting and what compels people to talk about it is the idea of a place, of uniqueness. Within that uniqueness that's fairly consistent from year to year, you have the variations from year to year based on weather patterns. But at its core, this place is expressing itself through the bottle, provided the steward of that grape and of that place are getting out of the way to allow that to happen."
"Maynard is an Arizona enological pioneer," Gago explained. "He is creative and quality-oriented and brings new perspective and a new audience for wine." After earning her agroecology degree from Prescott College, Nikki Bagley had been eager for practical experience. Joining the vineyard crew to hoe Bermuda grass and help bring in the 2008 harvest fit the bill. "It was great to see some truly sustainable agriculture going on in Yavapai County," she would recall. "I had struggled to imagine how agriculture fit into this arid county with all its water issues. It was wonderful to get in on the ground level of this amazing industry." It wasn't long before Maynard promoted Nikki to vineyard co-manager, and the two joined forces to help bring viniculture to Arizona. Winemaker allies who attended the first meeting of the Verde Valley Wine Consortium in 2008 were unanimous. Yavapai College should be the epicenter of education and resources for new winemakers. Trowel in hand, Maynard provided 2 years later an on-campus experimental site the Negro Amaro vineyard he planted where the campus racquetball court had once been. It was his investment that really showed the college that they could do this on a large scale, Nikki, the program's first instructor, explained. The next summer, Yavapai's Southwest Wine Center in Clarkdale became home to Arizona's first program to offer degrees in viticulture and enology. From a first-year enrollment of 30 students, the program had grown by 2016 to more than 90 future winemakers and vineyard owners and tasting room managers. Maynard and Nikki supported winemaker Joe Bouchard in his instrumental role in creating 2014 legislation allowing alternating partnerships, the ability for multiple Arizona wineries to share common production space. Owner of Clarkdale's Chateau Tumbleweed, Bouchard enabled Maynard's transformation of Camp Verde's former meatpacking plant to 4-8 Wine Works, the shared incubator allowing experienced but underfunded vintners to produce their limited releases until they are solvent enough to build bunkers of their own. In a spirit of camaraderie and support, winemakers share destemmers and tanks and the bottling line, knowledge and insights, and muscle at harvest time. And the next year, Maynard joined forces with equally committed professionals to put in place the Arizona Vignerons Alliance, a group dedicated to establishing parameters for grape growing and wine production and holding vintners to recognized international standards.
In light of the farm-to-table and local-first movements, it's important for us as a wine industry to at least start there. No product from an area will speak as loudly as wine about a specific place and time. The Arizona Vignerons Alliance is about aligning ourselves with the idea of the local and increasing understanding of what makes a region unique.
Of all the people in this industry, Maynard is one of the few that has taken a long-range view, Nikki said. He's one of the state's most visionary winemakers. He sees the future of Arizona wines, and he's pushing hard to get us there. As if his email ID needed further justification, he began investigating the development of next-generation subsurface drip irrigation. This could be a game-changer for vineyards in Arizona, he explained in early 2016. Growers and environmentalists would be pleased with the novel below-ground method that encouraged stronger root systems, conserved Arizona's precious water, and left no carbon footprint. Because of Maynard's generosity, these are significant things that will make a difference in Arizona, Tarbell would explain. He has the clearest voice about what Arizona wines are and could be. He's providing a very articulate, strong, intelligent role of leadership to the state's budding wine industry. And at every conference, every meeting, every planning session, Maynard shared stories. Stories of September afternoons in an apple orchard on Dar Road, of dreams of flying high above the evening desert, of a view from a rooftop in Somerville. Things come up that to most people would be irrelevant, Todd would explain, but they're so relevant and such a part of where things came from that for Maynard, they're a constant frame of reference, and they are relevant if you know the story.